Well, first of all, thank you very much to all of you for coming, and especially to Michel and the others, the other staff that invited me and gave me this opportunity to speak here. So basically, I'm going to speak about a field which is called relativistic quantum information, which is a mixture of three different fields. It's a bit of general relativity, a bit of quantum field theory, and a bit of quantum information. So basically, when this field was born, it was concerned about understanding what's the behavior of quantum correlations and quantum information, the availability of quantum information tasks in non-inertial settings. But for example, right now, the scope of the field is a bit more ambitious. For example, we would like to take advantage of gravity and acceleration as features that help us perform quantum information tasks in a more reliable way, and also use quantum information and quantum optics tools to try to characterize and understand quantum effects of gravitation and maybe help to construct a quantum theory for gravity at some point. So basically, I'm going to speak about some four examples of these things. So in these two, for example, I will show you how entanglement plays a role in some general relativistic phenomena. And the last two are going to be like uses of quantum optics tools to try to say something about general relativistic settings. So let's begin with the stellar collapse, all right? So when a star collapses, all right, you have entanglement generated in a quantum field modes defined in space-time. So basically, we need first to understand this, we need to do quantum field theory in a collapsing star background. But to do that, we readily see that we run into problems. Why? Because, well, this is a dynamical scenario. So there are problems to carry out field quantization. For example, there's no unique notion of vacuum. You have problems defining the Fock spaces and what's a positive and negative frequency depending on the observer and time. So in principle, you have problems, but in the case of a stellar collapse, you're lucky because you have asymptotically stationary regions. This is a conformal diagram. For those of you that are not familiarized with it, let me just tell you that this line here represents the asymptotic past, the null asymptotic past. So all the rays of light just come from here in the asymptotic past. This is the null asymptotic future. So all the rays of light that reach the future will reach it in this region. And this is the past of the things that have mass, right? Anything that have mass starts from here and may end up here, okay, unless it falls into the event horizon. And here, as you see, the event horizon of the forming black hole is this line. So in principle, in the asymptotic past, we have a Minkowskian spacetime. In the asymptotic future, we have a sort of spatial spacetime. And then we have rays of light that will reach the asymptotic, emitted in the past, that will reach the asymptotic future. But there are some others that will not reach the asymptotic future because they will fall into an event horizon and reach this wavy line, which is the singularity. All right? So the good thing here is that quantum field theory can be built in quite perfectly in the asymptotic past here and in the asymptotic future. All right? Well, I'm putting this different because, of course, this one has problems. So the relationship between them, between quantum field theories in the past and in the future, is the time evolution of those field states subjected to the gravitational interaction. So let's start. Sorry. When I mean quantum theory, build a quantum field theory, I mean building the Fock space. All right. So to build a Fock space, you need to identify the vacuum state first. Then you have to identify positive frequency modes and negative frequency modes. So that only can be done when you have a killing time lag killing vector, which is well defined. And it doesn't depend on the observer. You have an objective way to define those modes. So in dynamical scenarios, you in principle don't have global time lag killing vectors like you have in flat space time, for example. So to build a quantum field theory, we need first to identify positive, for example, you have the equations of your field, your classical field equations. And then you have to identify what's a positive energy solution of that equation and what's a negative energy solution. For that, you need a time derivative. For that, you need a killing vector, time lag killing vector. So I don't know if that answers what you're asking.
I mean, I'm familiar with what you said, but I understand what you meant by.
Okay, I will tell you in a minute. After this slide that comes after that, when you have still doubts, tell me.
I think what was confusing is that you implied that you had two different quantum field theories. One for the early time and one for the late time, instead of saying two different vacua or two different ground states in
You're right.
One single quantum field theory that applies to the whole space time.
That's correct, exactly. It's like we don't have different quantum field theories in that sense. You have different definitions of vacuum in the asymptotic past and in the asymptotic future. So that the states defined in the past using the time-like Killing vector in the past to identify positive or negative frequency, we're translating something different in the future. And that we will want to find, all right? So here, we like to define what are modes in the asymptotic future and modes in the asymptotic past, all right? So we can do it just solving the Weyl equations and asking what the form of those solutions are. Modes, monochromatic modes in the asymptotic past look like standard plane waves, because this is nothing but Minkowskian spacetime. Modes that form a basis of the asymptotic future, of solutions of the Weyl equations in the asymptotic future, look like that. But there's a problem, of course, because those modes are, of course, defined in the asymptotic future. But here, as we have a complete set of solutions of the Weyl equation, of the Friedel equations, but here we don't, because there are some modes that exist in the asymptotic past, but will never reach the future. There are some modes whose destiny is just falling into the event horizon. So we can also characterize those modes, and those modes play a role in order to describe what would be a quantum state in the future, all right? How would be the evolution subjected to the gravitational interaction from state in the past to state in the future. And if we add those modes, we can readily obtain that this is just in the language of quantum field theory, this is an annihilation operator of frequency omega prima in the asymptotic past. So one of those translates to a superposition of modes that reach the asymptotic future and modes to fall into the event horizon. If we compute what would be the form of the vacuum state in the past as seen in terms of modes in the future, we see that for a bosonic field and for a fermionic field, this is a scalar field, and this is a Grassmann scalar field, which is, let's say, a fermionic field spin zero, or one-dimensional Dirac field. So in both cases, we have here squeeze states, all right? So what happens here? The vacuum in the past translates into a squeeze state of modes that fall into the event horizon and modes that reach the asymptotic future. But of course, an observer in the future will never see the modes that fell into the horizon, all right? So to calculate what would be the quantum state, the quantum field state observed by an observer in the asymptotic future, we need to trace out the modes that fall into the horizon, and if we do that, we end up with a thermal state whose temperature is exactly what is called the Hawking radiation, the Hawking temperature, all right? So an observer in the future would observe an outgoing radiation coming from the horizon, undergoing a thermal spectrum, all right? So this is what is called the Hawking radiation. So the important point here for regarding what I'm going to talk about is that the state of modes that fall into the global state, made of modes that fall into the horizon and modes that reach the future, is entangled, all right? And the entanglement behavior is different whether you're considering bosons, bosonic fields, or fermionic fields, all right? So then that gives you two quick set of conclusions. The first one, which is not probably the most important, but this is probably the funnest one, all right? So if you have, you can see here that in the regime of what is called extreme black holes, which are black holes whose mass is very, very small, this is, for example, those micro black holes that can be generated in hypothetical high energy processes. Or for example, if you consider an evaporating black hole, its final state would be something like that, like an extremal black hole, a black hole whose mass is really, really, really small, all right? Well, for those cases, we can see that Hawking radiation, so the thermal emission that we detect in the asymptotic future, would be indeed maximally correlated with the infalling radiation. So what does that mean? Well, in the sci-fi side, that would mean, for example, that an observer falling into the horizon, imagine that you are falling into the horizon and you have a quantum state and you don't have energy to escape the horizon, all right? So then what you do is just, all right, let me carry out some measurement on my state here and also some measurement on the field, on the most of the field that are with me falling into the horizon. So I'm measuring the field here and a quantum state of the same dimension here, and then I generate a bunch of data. I'm going to die because I'm going to fall into the horizon, but I will send this data right to the future, all right? And then someone in the future will receive that data and then says, oh, if I do these operations to the Hawking radiation that this black hole is emitting, oh, I can teleport the state from that guy to me. Well, of course, this is just a sci-fi thing. But in the fundamental, from the fundamental point of view, it's got its importance, all right? But yeah.
This person has sent the information before they fell.
So, yeah, of course, before they fell. So it's not like sending information after the horizon. No. It's just sending information. Imagine that you don't have fuel to escape, but you haven't crossed the horizon yet, because it takes you a lot of energy to escape anyway. So you don't have the fuel, so you can decide to teleport information. Well, but this is just kind of fun result, right?
Can you explain what is this?
Yeah.
What are the axes on this? First of all, are you in 3+1 dimensions?
Well, this one is in 1+1, but can be exported to 3+1 quite easily. And the result wouldn't change. So you have an extra term and surface term that is added to that. If you go to higher dimensions, you will have a surface term that contributes to the entanglement entropy, but the behavior will be basically the same. So here in the x-axis, we have this omega parameter, which is a function of the mode of the field you're considering, you're analyzing, and the mass of the black hole, all right? And then this y-axis is the entanglement entropy of your state, okay?
What is this omega? It's frequency?
Frequency of the mode you're observing, yeah.
Measured where?
Measured by the observer in the asymptotic future. Sorry. This omega here. Exactly.
So basically that axis is the ratio of the wavelength and the radiation of the
black hole. Yep, that's it. Which is a function of mass and frequency of the mode.
So can you go back to a couple of slides where you have the calculation?
This one?
So the bipartition is inside the horizon, outside the horizon?
Not exactly, but almost. It's like.
So what is the hyperspace?
The hyperspace is, but the bipartition is modes that fall into the event horizon and modes that reach the asymptotic future. Okay? In the past, you only have, we don't have a bipartition in the past, because in the past we have only Minkowskian spacetime and we have modes defining the whole spacetime. But in the future, we have modes that really reach the future and modes that have been lost because they fell into the event horizon.
So you're in the fog space?
Yeah.
So can you explain in what sense this is entanglement? I mean, so you have a completely, this affirmance?
Those are bosons.
Bosons, okay. So you have a completely symmetric wave function and you think it's entangled?
Well, it's like parametric down conversion, actually. It's like having modes that are entangled in a two-mode squeeze state, like that. So if you compute the state, for example, the vacuum state in the past, when you change basis to the basis in the future, it's like computing an S-matrix evolution for gravity, then you end up, the past transforms into as two-mode squeeze states between modes that fall into the event horizon and modes that reach the future. That's what I'm saying. And those are, of course, occupation number. And if you trace out the modes that fell into the horizon, you have a thermal state of modes that reach the future.
Your expression for ground states prompts me to ask already now. We know that the black holes tend to violate all kinds of conservation laws. So in this case, it looks like you trace out, say, horizon states. You want to violate the superselection determinant?
Not really,
because I'm odd numbers just on the
exactly. In the fermionic case, I'm in the even sector only, and I don't get out the even sector.
That's because the reduced state will be in the you will have just half of the state. You will not have stuff like that.
Exactly. I mean, this is kind of notational only. I mean, that means one particle and one antiparticle.
Yeah.
So in principle, I'm in the global even sector of the superselection part.
Yeah. And then the reduced state. But then the reduced state still stays in the global even sector, because if you have even odd, and then trace out, you might run into trouble. Now it's maybe not surprising because black holes do all kinds of funny stuff.
In
this context, I would say logical, maybe logical, but
I don't
know whether it's indeed the case or not.
I'm not sure about that, actually. It's a nice question, because I haven't thought of that. But definitely what I can tell is that if you trace out here, which is a state that is perfectly superselection compliant, all right, then you end up with a thermal state. So in principle, as you have a mixed state, you have lost information. So in principle, it's not like having a violation of superselection rules that all the terms doesn't appear. It's just that you're not looking at the terms that this kind of stuff. So in principle, I think that could be circumvented. I don't know, but maybe I will have...
No, but that's something.
Yeah, I'll take a deeper look at that.
Because, like, people are against non-unitarity, but small variable number non-conservation and other stuff. So why not to?
Yeah, could be.
Tracing, you don't get superposition.
Yeah, we're supposed to have blocks, but you might have some matrix elements which are not supposed to be there. Or if you're lucky enough, in normal scenarios, they don't, it doesn't.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, now I'll take a deeper look on that. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So let's say sci-fi result of this is what would be the utility of this to analog gravity experiments. So what's analog gravity? Well, very briefly, analog gravity, that's why I put this toilet here, is using some solid state physics or fluid dynamics, quantum fluid dynamics, or some other stuff, to generate artificial horizons. I mean, you have, for example, the simplest way to think of this is considering a Bose-Einstein condensate, for example. Then you have phonons, which are quanta of vibration inside the Bose-Einstein condensate, and then the condensate moves with some speed. If that speed is greater than the speed of phonons inside the Bose-Einstein condensate, you have an effective horizon, all right? And then you can induce some geometry that resembles what will happen in space-time with a black hole, and then study what happens with the formation of horizons, all right, in this solid-state physics. And the equations tells you that to some extent, of course, not going to the high energy scales, in the scales that are, let's say, short, long enough to not to see the fine structure of the black hole or the material that you're considering, you have something that is mathematically completely equivalent to a black hole. So what you have here is that there's a problem, which is always controversial with someone publish something on these analogs, all right? It's the problem of distinguishing if the radiation they're observing in those analogs is classical or quantum. Why is that? Because in the quantum Hawking effect, the standard one, you start from the vacuum state of the field, and then you generate a horizon, and out of the vacuum state, you observe thermal radiation coming out. But in the case that of all of the experiments suggested in analogs, what you're doing is plugging in some state of the field, which is not the vacuum, because you cannot consider the vacuum, then generate the horizon, but it happens that classically, you can have also generation of thermal radiation if you generate a horizon in a classical background without quantum field theory. The differences are too small to be detected because the Hawking radiation, even in analog system, is too small, okay? So this is a real problem to distinguishing genuine Hawking, quantum Hawking effect from induced thermal radiation coming from the horizon, all right? So you have a classical theory, you will also observe Hawking-like radiation, but of course not in the vacuum state if you put some excitations on them. And distinguishing them is not easy. Well, sorry, yeah.
I don't understand what you mean by induced thermal radiation.
Okay, if you imagine that you have, for example, a space-time, all right? Just a flat space-time. And then you have a classical theory defining your space-time, like electromagnetism, like Maxwellian electromagnetism, all right? And then imagine that in the asymptotic past, you put like the vacuum state of your theory, which is nothing, because it's classical, and then you generate a horizon. You won't observe anything in the future because the vacuum state of the field just evolved to a vacuum state of the field classically. Problem is that if you, sir? Okay.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the vacuum state of
the field. The minimum
energy.
Zero field. Okay. E equals to zero, B equal to zero. That means you generate the horizon and you have zero everywhere. If the theory is quantum, that's when the Hawking radiation appears. The vacuum state actually, out of the vacuum, you observe thermal radiation and in falling modes. Problem is that in experiments, you're not putting the vacuum because you're working at some temperature and you have to distinguish your state that you're plugging in from the thermal background. So they put normally excitations, some sort of excitations. And the same thing happens quantum in a quantum way. The same thing happens with excitations. You have an excitation in the past and it evolves to a superposition of kind of thermal-ish states in the future. But if you do the classical thing again, if you start from for example, say a wave packet in the asymptotic past, or some state, even a non-local state in the asymptotic past, in the future when you generate the horizon, you also observe a thermal, classical thermal emission from the black hole in the asymptotic future, which means that.
That's what I don't understand what you mean by thermal. I guess that.
Well, some spectrum.
Yeah, you're talking just like stimulated emission.
Something like that. It's like totally similar to stimulated emission. That's it. Totally
so
analogous.
It's just an amplification.
Exactly.
Black hole is working like an amplifier. Basically, maybe a negative amplifier, but anyway.
Something like that. Basically, what you're doing is changing the boundary conditions. When you put in the horizon, in a classical.
I don't think I would call it circle, at least that was the confusion.
Well, noisy, let's say. Yeah, a noisy distribution.
Some noise.
Exactly. Some induced noise. You're right. Maybe thermal is not the way. But the problem is that distinguishing that noise from thermal Hawking radiation is difficult. And there's some controversy on if what you observe in those experiments can be distinguished from a classical effect.
Are you talking about experiments people have done or that they're thinking of?
Yeah, that, both of them.
Because the ones that have been done, I think there's no, I don't think there's any controversy. No one has actually observed Hawking radiation.
Yeah, that's true. But in case that you...
It's not even close.
That's true. You're right. You're right.
You're just observing classical amplification.
Exactly. So that's the point is that even if you're able to observe it, you have problems distinguishing it from classical effects that will mask them, all right? But there's something that has no classical analog and happens everywhere, which is the generation of entanglement. I mean, the Hawking effect not only just gives you a thermal radiation, if you're able to measure beyond the horizon, and as well as in the adjacent future, that in fact you can in those analog settings, then you can look for correlations in there. And then if some entanglement is found, you can be sure that this is not classical, it has no classical analog, all right? So for that, we can suggest to use entanglement to distinguish the quantum nature of the Hawking radiation. And if you do that, maybe you want to move, instead of using some of the proposals that are built with bosonic fields, with phonons, for example, you may want to go to and use fermions. There are some proposals with collective excitations that are fermionic in liquid, some phases of liquid helium. And also, there are some proposals in graphene as well. Well, if you're able to do some analog with fermionic fields, all right, then you can see that entanglement is more reliable for fermions. Why is that? It's not only because this line is above that one. It's just because for bosons, given the dimension of the Hilbert space, maximally entangled state means entanglement entropy going to infinity, because the dimension of the Hilbert space is infinity, you know? So for fermions, maximally entangled state for each mode means entropy equal to 2, because the Hilbert space of fermions, in the simplest case, we have particles and antiparticles, and the dimension is 4, all right? So that means that if we move a bit out of the limit of zero mass, we move like here, for example, we are much closer to the maximally entangled state for fermions than we are for bosons. It's basically that bosons have too many excitations, and measuring that entanglement is really, really difficult. You get the localized in all the modes, all right, let's say. So,
you're really proposing to measure this entanglement? So how are you going to?
No, I'm not proposing that. I'm just trying to analyze that. If you measure that entanglement, I'm not the one who suggested for the first time to use entanglement to distinguish those effects. I'm saying that if you use entanglement to distinguish those effects, then go for fermions. The way to measure that is just...
How do you use entanglement to distinguish?
Well, you have to measure modes that reach the asymptotic future and measures that fall into the horizon.
You can't measure those.
Yeah, you can. In analog gravity, you can, in principle, because you can access beyond the horizon. So that's the point. In analog gravity, the horizon is below C. That's the point. Analog gravity, we use the speed of sound instead of the speed of light. And then that means that we can actually access modes that are beyond the horizon.
But this calculation is done. Those results are not in an analog system.
No, but can be translated right away to the analog system because the mathematics are the same. The only thing that these are functions of different things instead of mass of black hole. But yeah, the modes are... quite easily translated to, or the results are quite easily translated to analog systems. So maybe we can discuss that afterwards because it's quite a long talk and there's a lot of topics to talk about yet. Okay, this is regarding stellar collapse. So another scenario that may be of interest is considering the expansion of the universe as a source of quantum entanglement, right? So the setting, let me present it. In mind that we consider a Friedman-Robertson-Walker standard space-time, where this is the scaling factor as a function of the conformal time eta, all right? So, in principle, for an arbitrary expansion, there's not too much to say due to those problems of building quantum field theories properly. We have to be really, really careful. But there are some regimes where computing things is quite easy. Those are the regimes where we have asymptotically stationary regions. For example, imagine the case in which you have a normal stationary spacetime, then at some point, a really, really fast expansion occurs, and then at some point again, it goes to similar to a stationary spacetime. That models quite well, for example, inflationary periods, all right? An inflationary period is just a period in which the expansion of the universe is much faster than the expansion of the universe before the inflationary period. And again, when the inflationary period finishes, then the expansion is again slower, much lower than the expansion of the speed of expansion in the inflationary period. So in those scenarios, we can perfectly build these vacuum states, all right? They identify positive and negative frequency modes because the space-time admits this time-like Killing vector in the asymptotic regions. So we can do that, express the vacuum state in the past as a function of modes in the future and ask ourselves what would be the form of this. Well, if we do that in general, we end up finding this expression, so the vacuum state in the past before the expansion transforms into that state in the future, and that state of the field in the future, I will tell you about these things afterwards, it has some entanglement entropy, actually. So that's, this state is entangled. Only if the fields you're considering, you're observing are massive. If the fields are massless, you don't see any entanglement generated by the expansion of the universe. So this is quite abstract. We haven't plugged in any model, right? But we can analyze a real model and see if this entanglement has any information about the parameters of the expansion. So I will use this model, which is called the Duncan model, that modelizes a kind of idealized inflationary period. And I'm using it because it's analytically solvable and it's quite nice to study, all right? So basically, this model means that the factor is one in the asymptotic past. The factor is this total volume of expansion plus one in the asymptotic future. And then in the middle, we have some sort of hyperbolic tangent-like expansion, like, let's say, exponential near the horizon, all right? Near the origin, sorry. So there are two parameters here. One is the total volume of expansion, epsilon, and the other one, rho, is the rapidity of the expansion, all right? Because this is a function of time with a rho times the conformal time, all right? So then we find that the behavior with the rapidity of the expansion is... Yeah, of course.
Why do you say that the vastless fields don't... Sorry? You said vastless fields do not get entangled.
Yeah.
Do you mean there's no particle creation? What do you mean?
There is particle creation, but
there's
no entangled. That's the other thing I'm saying.
Why is that?
Well, because in principle, I can ask it in a physical way that, but in principle, mass is what actually, in the density matrix, the terms that are the coherent terms, the ones that give you entanglement are proportional to mass. I don't have a physical reason to do that, but mass just say that. If you have massless field, you don't have entanglement. So I don't have a more satisfactory answer to that yet.
When you say entanglement, you mean entanglement between different modes? What is it that you mean by
entanglement?
In one case, it was the horizon modes.
It's entanglement between the two first elements of the even sector of the superselection space. So it's between the vacuum state and particle antiparticle. Between the vacuum state and this, let's say, particle antiparticle noise. This one particle, one antiparticle. So this is the kind of state, all right? Vacuums superimposed with a pair of particle and antiparticle, all right?
Sorry, what do you mean there's entanglement between, I mean...
Well, this is an
also type. Entanglement, yeah, we're normally talking about some separated...
Yeah, well, this is a bipartite system, actually. This is just considering the sector of particles and the antiparticle sector, all right? These two sectors are entangled, that's what I'm saying. This vacuum actually is... 0, 0, let's say. It's vacuum for particles, vacuum for antiparticles, all right? And this is the state, one particle and one antiparticle.
So the particle modes and the antiparticle.
Exactly, that's it. Entanglement between neutrino and antineutrinos, if you want, you know?
So if you were doing, say, a Majorana Fermi, and there'd be no entanglement?
In principle, yes. Majorana Fermi would be no entanglement. But, it depends. No, because I'm assuming, I'm assuming direct dynamics. So we have to repeat the calculation for Majorana fermions.
But what would be the entanglement? What would the entanglement be between?
Oh no, I don't know. That's a nice, that's an interesting calculation to make about that. Yeah. I mean, we have to replace the thing and instead of the Dirac dynamics into the Majorana dynamics and see what happens. Maybe that's the thing.
But I'm just saying, there's no distinction between the particle and the antiparticle.
That's true.
So what is it that is being entangled?
Probably
if
is.
If you did the calculation, what would you be?
0 plus 2. Like 0, 0 plus particle particle in modes that are right moving and left moving, for example.
So you'd entangle the right mover.
Exactly. Yeah. There are two questions.
So I understand you have only one particle modes, with just a pair, one pair?
No, well, this is just because I just showed you here the fermionic case, in which there's a Pauli exclusion principle and then no other modes. In the bosonic case, you have a superposition of all the even sector of superselection. So you have vacuum plus particle, antiparticle, right mover, left mover, plus two particle, right mover, two particle, antiparticle, left movers. That would be the kind of state that you will have. Okay.
So are you assuming that outside the inflationary value, are you assuming that outside the inflationary value you have a time-like healing?
Yeah.
You say that, but this doesn't happen.
Approximately. Okay. I mean, depending.
In comparison with the period of
exactly.
Inflation.
Exactly. It's just that this is this. I'm assuming here that the expansion is frozen in the asymptotic future.
So you assume that you have Minkowski outside.
Yeah.
How do you choose your one?
Exactly, that's it. That's the assumption. Actually, this model is great. This is a nice question because a thing to explore is that what will happen if we don't study this kind of simple model? What will happen if we study realistic models like with this accelerated expansion, for example, model? That this is a bit more complicated, but I think the tools are here. The only things that the maths are more complicated, the tools are the same. To analyze that, that will happen with that. Well, in these simple models, this just try to be a fundamental result. I mean, in principle, it's not applying. It's not like too ambitious in the sense that we're saying that we're reproducing something that we can measure tomorrow or something like that. So basically, what I wanted to say here is that the bosons and fermions. Wow, I'm running out. How much time do I have, by the way? Because
about another. 20 minutes?
Well, I will have to go faster, definitely, because there's a lot to say. Sorry?
Faster.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that there are differences between bosons and fermions. Maybe I will left out some parts in that.
Yeah, that's probably better.
Yeah. So there are some very important difference between fermions and bosons, right here. Well, with fermions, we see that modes of, well, for bosons, modes of less energy get more entangled with less momentum, get more entangled. That means that it's easier, it makes sense because it's easier to excite and to create particles in the low frequency modes because it's less expensive, right? It's cheaper. In the fermionic case, we see that there's a frequency that gets more entangled than the others, and that has to do with the characteristic length of the mode. I mean, there's some sort of Pauli exclusion principle preventing the creation of particles if the modes are too long, actually. So if the fermionic modes are too long, the characteristic length of those modes are too long, the generation of particles actually is smaller, and so is the generation of entanglement. So the thing is that this mode of maximal entangled creation for a given mass, it's a function of the rapidity of the expansion, but it's almost insensitive to the total volume of expansion, all right? So what happens here is that, yes, if you were able to measure what's the frequency that gets more entangled, so you have kind of a tuning entanglement detector, and then you go to one frequency, another, and then you find the one who's most entangled, that will give you complete information about the total volume of the expansion. And conversely, the amount of entanglement in that mode, so if in that mode you're not looking which one is the one who's most entangled, let's say, how much entanglement can I find in this mode, then that gives you information about the total volume of expansion, but it's completely insensitive to the rapidity. So using this kind of looking for the maximum entanglement frequency protocol, you can give complete information. You can give complete information about the expansion just using this protocol, let's say, of measuring which one is the mode that's most entangled and how much entanglement is in this mode. All right? Okay, so in principle, you can use, at least in foundations, in the foundation side, quantum information techniques to obtain cosmological information. Next thing I would like to talk about, I'll be quite quick about that, it's just,
I'm not sure where there is any quantum information you just described. It seems to me that it's, when you're using quantum field theory in those space-time techniques, you're calculating something which you call in some measure of time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no sense in which you're doing any quantum information processing.
Totally true.
There's no chance of doing it either.
There's no what?
There's no chance of doing it. There's no possibility of using these modes to do any kind of quantum information processing.
That's true. In
They're
principle.
Highly non-local.
Yeah.
You can't measure them. You can't manipulate them like you do. So in what sense is what you've done anything to do with quantum?
Well, in the sense that there's the resource of entanglement, and in principle, you look, for example, at correlation, let's say, in the neutrino background. Imagine that you have a neutrino background that happened and was emitted in some inflationary period. In that sense, you're looking at really long distances, and then you're looking at, in a good approximation, to really extended modes, modes that are defining the whole space-time in a way. And then there, you can look for correlations in the thermal, in the neutrino background. Those correlations, if you look well and you're able to measure them in a way that, of course, I'm not saying that that's possible, but imagine that you have a perfect neutrino detector in a way, in the future, some sort of detector that can measure that with some reliability, you will be able to say things about that entanglement. Because that gives you deep correlations that wouldn't be there if the state were not entangled. That's basically what I'm saying. But that's in the case that you were able to measure them, of course, that you can't, in principle, at least now. What I'm saying is that the resource is there.
Well, to measure entanglement, don't you need many copies of the system?
Yep.
But you don't have many copies of
well, if you
each
have a,
of these.
If you have the background, you have the kind of, you can look for like spatial correlations in the background, and the behaviors would expect to be the same behavior in that one. Instead of defining this, the localized fixed frequency modes, I kind of try to localize the mode in long lengths, like the ones corresponding to what we'll be observing in a background graph, then the same things can be repeated and obtain quite similar results. So that's the implication. But of course, I'm not claiming that this is going to be a way to detect the. I'm just saying that there are some information encoded in entanglement, information that, of the expansion of the universe. That's my only claim.
I probably should ask again what you just said, but are you saying that even though maybe there is no quantum information used for those correlations, might be possible to read, to learn about the history or the past of the universe by, so the character of whatever expansion you have, that will determine the type of background,
the correlations, yeah.
But when you say correlations between whom and whom?
Correlations between different, for example, imagine you have the background and you can associate some characteristic length to part of the background spectrum. Then correlation between different parts of the spectrum. For example, let's say the particle and antiparticle background, the neutrino and the antineutrino background, for example. You can compare that and look for correlations there. If you find correlations that are different from the standard way that we have the same number, it's like we have the same, it's not a symmetric state between neutrinos and antineutrinos. So there are some correlations between the two, and those correlations are a function of the history of expansion. And those correlations reflect the entanglement that it has. So in principle, but of course, I'm defending here that you will be able to measure it.
I'm not worried about that. I just want to understand what you're saying is that by looking at the background, neutrino background radiation, we will be able to learn about
the history.
The history, but by looking, but the reason why we will be learning is because of entanglement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, at least that's a way. I haven't checked if there's some classical correlations going on as well. But the one I computed are the quantum correlation, like the entanglement, actually. Well, very quickly, this thing. I will spare you the explanation about the Unruh effect that I have here. So basically, it has to do solving the wave equations in different set of coordinates. The Minkowski set of coordinates give you a complete basis of solutions of this equation. From that, you can construct a quantum field theory. But if you consider an accelerated observer, the solutions to that equation doesn't form a complete set of solutions because of the horizon that is here. This horizon prevents an observer here from accessing modes in this region. That means that his modes, has only support in this region of spacetime. So it is not a complete basis of solutions defined in the whole spacetime. To have a complete one, we have to add another accelerated observer, another accelerated set of coordinates, and then solve the equations, get another set of solutions which is complete in this region, and with these two, we can build a complete basis for the field, for the solutions of the equation in defining the whole spacetime. Using those, we can build a quantum field theory based on those modes, a Fock space based on those modes, or equivalently, the same thing, but based on the modes defined in these two regions. Of course, this is an equal sign here. It is the same field. So we can do the quantization in the Rydberg basis or the Minkowskian basis, all right? So the thing is that the change of basis is not trivial. Actually, it gives you some new apparent physics. The vacuum state of the field translates into a two-mode free state, as I said before. So if you trace out the modes that an accelerated observer cannot access because they are in region 2, you end up with a thermal state, and that state has a temperature which is proportional to the acceleration, that's the Unruhe. So basically, summarizing very much, the Unruhe is like when an inertial observer observes the vacuum state of a field, an accelerated observer would observe a thermal bath whose temperature is proportional to the acceleration. Problem is that this effect is actually too small to be detected. I mean, even the best proposals before the one I'm going to present require acceleration that are that high that are completely impossible to even get close with current technology. Okay, but what I'm going to talk about is that using something different, using the acquisition of geometrical phases.
So what is the temperature for even this absurd acceleration?
For let's say for an acceleration of 10 to the 21 meters per second square, you have one Kelvin. So it's really small. So the thing is that kind of very quickly, if you have an evolution, okay, whose Hamiltonian is dependent on time, all right, but it's dependent on time through a set of cyclically but adiabatically varying parameters, and then you have some adiabatic evolution and your state evolves to the same state plus a dynamical phase plus a geometrical phase depending on the geometry of your system in your parameter space, right? This geometrical phase can be computed like that. I'm not going to go into details, but the main idea here is that a detector moving through space-time acquires a global Verrier phase, all right? So to simplify things, simplest model, consider a single mode through the width detector, all right? For an inertial observer, this phase here, this is the detector in a mixed picture, Schrödinger for the detector and interaction for the field, right? So for this inertial observer, this phase here depends on the trajectory of the observer like that, all right? This is the Lorentz invariant element, right? So the movement of the detector in space-time actually generates a change in the interaction Hamiltonian. This thing is dependent on time through the trajectory that the detector is following. So the change is also cyclic, because after a time proportional to 1 over the natural frequency of the field mode we are considering, this parameter phi completes a 2 pi cycle in the parameter space, all right? So it completes a closed trajectory in the parameter space. The Hamiltonian, as it is as simple as it is, can be diagonalized exactly, and then we can try to compute what will be the geometrical phase, if any, acquired by a detector moving through space, all right? Well, we can do the same for an accelerated detector, actually. For an accelerated detector, those operators are different. What I'm doing here is just expressing these field operators in the NAC. We have a detector whose proper frequency is omega, then they couple to the field in the, let's say, the Rydberg basis, all right? The modes, to describe the Hamiltonian with the safe, we have two options. Or we change coordinates in the Minkowskian Hamiltonians, or we rewrite the Hamiltonians in terms of Rydberg operators.
Sorry. The change of the parameters for the Hamiltonian simulating the motion of the detectors is accelerated. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that the detector, just for the fact that he's moving through space-time,
yeah,
it's a Hamiltonian which is dependent on time in a way that is cyclic,
right?
And I will discuss if it is adiabatic as well. And
yeah, because that's the good.
Yeah, so I will.
Why it's adiabatic?
I will go for that after this one. Well, the same can be repeated for the accelerated case. All right. So to spare you some details, here, the experiment proposed is, for example, an important thing is that the phase acquired, I will discuss the adiabatic thing after this one. The phase acquired is the same for every inertial observer. Any inertial observer, no matter what, acquires the same phase, which is expected, actually, because the varying phase is the Lorentz invariant phase. That means that any inertial observer is equivalent to any other regarding this phase. But it's different in the accelerated case, and it is a function of the acceleration, okay? So basically, in the inertial scenario, before turning on the interaction, let's say that we start in the vacuum state of the field. Then at some point, we suddenly switch on the interaction. When this interaction is switched on, it can be easily proved that the vacuum state of the field evolves to the dressed vacuum state of the complete Hamiltonian. So this is the ground state of the complete Hamiltonian, all right? For the accelerated case, the state of the field is the thermal state that corresponds to the Unruh effect, actually. The detector who's accelerating is not radiating against the vacuum. He's radiating against a thermal state that he's observing because he's accelerating, all right? Well, if we suddenly switch on the interaction, we have a small, quite small, but still non-negligible excitation probability, but we can carry out a projective measurement and make sure that the detector is in the ground state, all right? If we do that, we can make sure that after the interaction is switched on, the state of the detector and the field is the dressed version of this state, all right? So then, we require the evolution to be adiabatic. That means, actually, it's less demanding than that. Adiabatic is too strong. But the only thing that we require here, because of the state we're studying, is in the inertial case and in the accelerated case as well. If we start with the vacuum, so the ground state of the detector, we evolve to the ground state of the detector. So I mean, for example, if we are in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian at time t, then after time t plus delta t, we are in the corresponding eigenstate of the Hamiltonian at this time. All right. So plugging in realistic coupling regimes and even the accelerated case acceleration required, this probability of excitations, that is an estimator of this adiabatic approximation wellness, actually is quite good. I mean, we are below. Well, actually makes sense. I mean, this is the probability of getting excited radiating against the vacuum if you start in the ground state of the detector. And when you are thermal, is the probability of radiating against this thermal bath that is really, really small until you get really, really high accelerations. So for the accelerations considered, this approximation really holds very well. So then we can use various formalism to compute the phase acquired after a cycle of adiabatic evolution. As I said, the phase is the same for an inertial detector, but it's a function of the acceleration. Okay? So basically, the phase difference is detectable for only one cycle. So, this is the last thing I'm going to tell you today. A way to implement this is using, for example, atomic interferometry, because of course, every phase is a global phase, so you need some interferometric experiment to measure it, all right? So imagine that you consider an inertial detector, and then at some point, you have a double slit. Like imagine that the detector is an atom, two-level system or many-level system, then you have a slit here. And then in one of the paths, you apply a potential that accelerates an atom, and in the other one, you don't, all right? So, and then you make them interfere at some point in the future, all right? So then what we obtain is that we have to sustain accelerations only 10 to the 16th g, but for times only of nanoseconds, all right? So the previous best result was 10 to the 15th g. So the previous best result that tried to measure the real Unruh effect, not analog or anything else, required 10 to the 15th g, all right? So with this setting, we require acceleration for that. Are those realistic? Well, there's some theoretical papers on atomic physics where they say they can accelerate atoms like that to this order of magnitude without breaking their coherence and affecting the internal state of the atoms. You do very carefully. It hasn't been done in the lab, but anyway, this is way better than this other one. It's 1 billion times better. Actually, if you look for here, we plugged in the standard gaps for atomic detectors, which are in the microwave regime, right, the ones used normally for these experiments. But if we're able to use a two-level system whose gap is smaller, let's say, I don't know, 5 structure levels or something like that, you're able to engineer that. If the frequency of the gap is only megahertz instead of gigahertz, you require acceleration. Actually, the acceleration required goes down proportional to the frequency of the gap of the detector you're analyzing. Actually, this is even better because the difference of phase accumulates. So if we're not able to see the phase in one cycle, we can wait for a number of cycles, and the difference of phase accumulates, and it's much better, actually, because the phase acquired is independent of the acceleration sign. So we can alternate an acceleration time with a breaking time, and then end up with atoms on the screen, with the same relative velocity, which is really good because you have very different relative velocities, then the interferometry pattern, the visibility, just goes down as the difference of speeds. So it's really good to alternate one cycle of acceleration and one cycle of deceleration, and the phase acquired in both adds up. You have twice the phase as only the acceleration path. So, well, I will stop here because I don't have time to go through this simulating thing. But basically, this this was going to be about using solid-state system like ion trap system or CQKD system to simulate the physics of accelerated detectors, going much beyond that the limit of classical computers to study collective phenomena. Of, imagine that you have many instead of having one detector trying to detect the Unruh effect, imagine you have an array of detectors, all of them coupled to the same field. We know from atomic physics that there's a phenomenon called superradiance that amplifies the probability of excitations of the whole, or at least one of the detectors of the whole array. So maybe we can use that to detect the Unruh effect. What's the problem? Undergoing the calculations for that many emitters coupled to the field, it's beyond computational power of any computer today. Well, using quantum simulations, we can go orders of magnitude beyond that, and we can do both, observe those effects in trapped ion system and CQKD system that is interesting enough for some people, but also go beyond that and give some result of calculations that may help to detect the real Unruh effect by exploring the many emitters regime, many body effects related to that, and then propose an experiment where the probability of detecting the Unruh effect is much higher than in previous settings with only one emitter. And that's everything I'll tell you today. Thank you.
So, are there more questions?
Yep.
So you're saying that for those parameters, so for the acceleration, you would have only the probability of an excitation that is 10 to the minus 10? And
yep.
So what adiabatic approximation are you using to?
Well, the approximation that I need, I mean, it's called adiabatic because it's called adiabatic in the literature, but it's, as I told you, it's less strong than adiabatic. The approximation that I need is that if I start with my detector and the field in some state, okay, then after some time evolution, this state will go with probability near to one to a state which is this state, just this is the same eigenstate, let's say, or combination of eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but instead of the Hamiltonian at time equal t, the Hamiltonian at time equal, so that's the probability I computed actually.
Very good. And what does this probability of the error depend on? Your approximation, so it depends on the gap, right? And on the speed of the variation of the Hamiltonian. You say it does not depend on the secondary derivative.
It depends on the gap, of course, of the atom.
So does it depend on the second derivative?
Well, actually, the probability, this approximation to be, the approximation is also good in the megahertz regime. We did the numbers also for the mega, instead of gigahertz that we consider for those numbers, we did it in the megahertz regime. And this approximation was fulfilled, the probability, that probability was 10 to the minus 4, still good for the approximation. But I haven't computed the dependence as a function of if it's a derivative or not. I can tell you that.
We can talk.
Yeah, yeah. I can tell you that for gigahertz is 10 to the minus 10, it's lesser than that, and for megahertz is 10 to the minus 4, still good, but less good. Yep.
Can you just describe the experiment you had in mind about detecting the Unruh, I mean using this geometric phase to detect?
Yeah.
If you could do the experiment, what would you actually do?
You will have an atomic interferometer. It's quite a tricky experiment, but in principle, it's based on cavern technology. So that the experiment would be considering an atomic interferometer, all right? And then at some point you have a double slit, all right? Then you have an atom, which is your detector. And then the atom goes through the double slit, okay? Then you have two paths of the interferometer. One path, you subject it to an acceleration, just engineering some.
The double slit is not the interferometer.
No. The double slit is just a double slit, right?
But then you have an interferometer.
Yeah, I mean it's like a standard atomic interferometer. What they use to measure.
Is that something like a Mach extender? I don't know what
it's similar.
Interferometer
okay, is. That's a setting that has been actually used to measure. I mean the most precise measurement that we have of time dilation due to gravity in the surface of Earth was done with one of those. What they did is just an atomic interferometer that has is similar. Schematically, it's like a Mach extender, something like that. But physically, it's a double slit, all right? And then you have two optical paths of atoms, all right? And for example, to measure the time dilation of Earth here in the surface of Earth, they have one path that is slightly lower than the other. So the field is stronger here. It's just I think the distance is of order 10 to the minus 7, minus 8 between the paths or something like that, because you need to keep coherence between the atoms, between the two paths, all right? So then, after some point, you make them coincide, okay? You re-guide again the beams and then make it coincide on a screen, and then you can see the interference patterns that you have there. And the lens there, I think, can be seen with an optical microscope. I mean, the maximum, minimum pattern can be, it's like a micro, or micros, something like that. But what I propose here is quite similar to that, actually. The only thing is that in one path, you have to do something like focus a laser or something and engineer a potential that accelerates one of the atoms.
But how many slits do you have? So you have two slits.
Yeah, two
slits. Then you have another set of two slits? Or
not? No. Just
so it's just an ordinary diffraction.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, but this.
You're producing a phase shift by this acceleration.
Exactly. And that phase
so
is.
Why do you, okay.
It's a function of the Umbro effect, actually. It's a
so
function
why
of,
do you call that the Umbro effect? That's what I don't know.
Oh, because this all relies, so this phase is the same for an inertial atom. There wouldn't be any phase if you consider two different inertial atoms, all right? Different, I mean, with different speeds, all right? With different, if you can I write somewhere? Yeah. If you consider, okay, for example, an atom going like that, this is, of course, space-time diagram. An atom going like that, and an atom going like that, both acquire the same geometrical phase. The phase is different only if they accelerate. And why?
But why would they acquire any geometric?
Because the Hamiltonian is still varying. This Hamiltonian
why
I said.
Why is the Hamiltonian varying?
Because it's a function of the trajectory of the. Imagine, for example, that you are in position x equals 0. Then you have a phase that varies with time, like omega t. And it describes cycles.
Experimentally, what's going on? I just don't understand. Is there some background field?
Yeah, of course. You have a detector coupled to a background field, like the electromagnetic field, for example. And this is those are fields operators.
Are you interfering two detectors, or are you interfering two atoms?
We need two detectors, okay? One is inertial, and the other one is accelerated, all right? And
so
then we make the interference.
So sorry, when you say we have one inertial detector and one, you actually mean atoms. You're thinking of atoms.
That's it.
But there are two of them, or is it a single one that's either going
single one that goes through an atomic interferometer, like a standard atomic interferometry. Those experiments I told you about are done with one atom. You have a double slit with the characteristic length of the atom, and then you have two paths, two optical paths, all right? And then you have an interference between the quantum states of the atoms, yeah.
But and when you said there's a field, you actually mean that So it's coupled to the electromagnetic field. Is that the vacuum state of the field? Okay.
The vacuum state of the field for the inertial one, but the accelerated one wouldn't see the vacuum, would see the thermal emission.
No, but why would there be a varying phase? What's changing in the inertial motion?
This phase over here. Well, let me put it. This, the Hamiltonian, the interaction Hamiltonian, okay, has phases that change with time, actually. The phase of the field operators is a function of time. So that's the adiabatic change. That is a cyclic change for it. Yeah.
You know, actually, it's again probably understanding question. I sort of see why it's on. I don't see why it's geometric. So in what sense is the geometric phase? I mean, it's an acceleration dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Fine.
Well, because it's different from the dynamical phase. And
yes.
Is that why? Because a cyclic, yeah.
But I mean, if you have different accelerations, you sort of have different trajectories, and then it's.
It's geometrical in the parameter space. I mean, you have to map these things to a parameter space. One parameter of this space is this phi, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And this phi in the parameter space undergoes adiabatic cycles, okay? Because it oscillates with the frequency of the field.
Yeah, and then actually, the actual phase is related to this parameter as a cumulative function of everything that goes in.
It's a function of everything that goes
yeah,
in.
Yeah, but, okay, and in that sense it's geometric. It's not geometric for trajectory.
No, for the space time, exactly. I mean, it's a geometric phase in the sense of the parameter space, of course. If you map these things to the parameter space, and then you can look at the evolution in the two different spaces, in the space-time, and then you have some evolution, and in the parameter space. In the parameter space, the evolution goes like that, and the geometry is not trivial. That's basically it.
I guess maybe it's a question of what picture you're using that makes it look like a geometric.
Exactly, that's it. No, I mean, the result is not picture dependent, of course. But there's one picture in which you can use Berry's formalism. There are many ways to compute Berry phase, all right? Depending on the picture in which you are.
It's naively, if you just have something sitting still, which is a special case, an atom sitting still, which is a special case of inertial motion.
Yeah, which is x
in
equals.
In a vacuum,
yeah.
Then there's no time dependence.
It is.
In the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, yeah, I mean.
It's not the Hamiltonian, it's not time.
No, no, depending on the Hamiltonian, the picture.
On the, maybe in the picture, the
because,
shows
yeah.
It might have time dependence.
But to compute Berry phase, it's important to be in the right picture. Because if you're in different pictures, you have to use another formalism. I mean, the way to compute Berry
phase. Any picture should be equivalent.
No, yeah, yeah, the results are equivalent. But the way to compute Berry phase is different depending on the picture in which you are. If you are in the.
Don't all you really care about is the extra phase induced by the acceleration?
No, no, no.
Isn't that right?
No. The thing is that. Let's explain it another way. To compute Berry phase, all right, what you need is a Schrodinger picture.
Well, let's forget about Berry.
Okay.
In your actual interference experiment, you just have two paths, and in one of them you kick the particle, and one of them the other, and the other you don't. So what you're really interested in is the extra phase introduced by that process of kicking.
I see your question now. This is not the phase that it acquires. The phase, the geometrical phase, is something different computed using some heavy formalism, actually. It's not as simple as this phase. I'm saying that this Hamiltonian, in the picture, that these calculations can be done. I mean, because depending on the picture in which you are, you have to use Pachadambran formalism or Berry's formalism to compute the Berry phase, all right? Both are equivalent, both give you the same result, but they require the Hamiltonian to be in different pictures, okay? So the thing is that if you're in the proper picture and apply the Berry's formalism, which is equivalent to being in another picture and apply the Pachadambran formalism, all right, the Berry phase is a function of all the parameters of the Hamiltonian. It's not that phase, of course, that disappears in some pictures and another. It's a function of all the parameters in the Hamiltonian. Actually, it's a function of omega, omega, and lambda only.
Okay, I don't really understand why it's essential, but you can think of the Berry phase.
Okay.
But what I would like to understand more is why you call this detection of the under effect.
Yeah.
It's an effect of acceleration.
Yeah, because, yeah.
But why is it the same as having a thermal state?
Because this is based, the difference of phase is based on what is the state of the field when the detector interacts. If the state is the vacuum state, okay, then you have one phase. If the state is a thermal state, you have another phase, all right? As an accelerated observer sees a thermal state due to the Unruh effect, detecting that thermal state will be detecting the Unruh effect. So this is nothing but a quantum thermometer, let's say, that is comparing to different temperatures, okay? So we have an accelerated detector. We make sure that we are in the vacuum state of the field, or something similar to the vacuum, okay, as close as possible. Then we have two detectors, one which is inertial and sees the vacuum, and one which is accelerated, that due to the Unruh effect, sees a thermal bath. This experiment will detect that thermal bath. That's what I'm saying, I'm detecting the Unruh
effect. So if instead of kicking it, you just ran it through some thermal bath?
It would be the same, yeah.
Would you see this same effect?
Yep.
Interesting, but it's a little strange. Naively, thermal things don't—they just destroy.
True. I'm actually working.
They won't. They won't.
It's a really good question. I'm actually working in this, in the thermometer version of this, just using this as a thermometer, and there I computed whether the coherent times and the times where the thermal noise destroys the not only the coherence but also the approximation that I do, this adiabatic approximation. All right. Well, it happens that the times of interaction, and it's only one cycle. Or two cycles of evolution, in this case nanoseconds. Nanoseconds with temperatures, as the temperatures are small, as you would expect for the Unruh effect, introduce zero decoherence in your system. And the coherence time is much longer than the time you need the atom to interact with the thermal state.
So you're saying a thermal state can introduce not only decoherence, but some sort of systematic phase shift?
Yep. And those can be, there are techniques to get rid of those, yeah.
That's what you want to see. But I still don't understand. What are you seeing? You're seeing the fact, and suppose instead of accelerating, we just ran it through an oven or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
So now what are we... I could imagine that the oven would destroy the interference pattern.
Yeah.
But that's not what you're looking for.
Yeah.
You're looking... So what are you looking for?
I'm looking for a phase that the detector acquires due to the differences between the interaction Hamiltonians and the way that they depend on time. So the problem is, the thing is,
but also your initial state.
Sorry?
I mean, it's not just interference.
I don't know, yeah, the initial state, sorry, yeah. I said that, yeah, sorry. It's a function of the initial state, of course. So the phase acquires.
So usually you compare the two phases acquired for two different cycles, but the same starting point, right? So here
about
two different states.
The atom, yes, but the field in different states. You know, the starting point in one case is vacuum or one thermal state, and the detector in the ground state. And the starting point on the other case is the ground state of the atom as well,
okay,
but a different field state.
Yeah.
In that sense, they are different starting points.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's why they give you different phases.
Yeah. So I think it seems to me that it is only because of the initial state.
It's true, but the way.
Not because of what you're.
It's true, but that's the point is that the state that you see is dependent on the trajectory in space-time. That's the unreflect thing all about.
Right.
That depending on your state of motion, you see different states of the field.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you got it totally right. That's it. Maybe when we talk, I can show you more detail of this. I will show you some of the mathematics involved.
But can someone test this? Suppose someone wanted to calibrate the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So they could just put a little black body, a little sort of oven or something,
yep,
and run it through. And what would they see? Would they see a shift in the diffraction pattern? And what would they see?
They would see a different interference pattern because the phase, actually, the optical path, the equivalent optical path would be different.
Interference pattern that depends on the temperature.
Correct.
You could use this as a kind of thermometer.
Correct. That's it. Actually, it's a high precision thermometer because it's really sensitive. It's really sensitive to small temperatures, but almost insensitive to high temperatures. So imagine you have a hot source that you can use as a pattern. You don't need a high precision in the hot source to measure the interference with the colder source, and then you can be really, really, really precise determining the temperature of the cold source.
But this could be experimentally realized.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever done something?
Well, the paper just came out. We're starting to.
This is nothing to do with the Andrew effect.
Yeah, sure. But we're actually working now in the thermometer phase. So, yeah, hopefully we will have it finished like in 1 month or so.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.